as of right now, 2:09 Central Time. We have 67,865 abortions being performed today, bringing our yearly total to 5,591,949 abortions being performed as of this year. So today is President's Day, and one of the many things that pop up, and when I say many things, the thing that pops up the most is, besides Facebook battles about which president is the best, which is a ridiculous topic for another time, are these top 10 lists. Although lately, depending on which academic or whoever is producing the list, they do worst 10, and then they use that as an opportunity to say, George W. Bush, George H.W., and so forth and so forth, which honestly wouldn't bother me too much anyway, because any of these presidents besides a select few have operated outside of their constitutional authority. But when we have those top 10 president lists, it's always George Washington's name at the top, unless you get somebody who's really just nuts and they put Lincoln. It's either one of those two, Washington or Lincoln. And let's see, one thing that's been increasing as of late is the religious aspect of Washington. How religious was he? What religion did he practice? And so forth. Now, according to Washington biographer Edward Lengel, he was, quote, he was a very moral man. He was a very virtuous man, and he watched carefully everything he did. But he certainly doesn't fit our concept of a Christian evangelical or somebody who reads the Bible every day. And he lived by a particular Christian theology. We can say that he was not an atheist on the one hand, but on the other hand, he was not a devout Christian. But what's the story of him kneeling in the snow at Valley Forge to pray? So according to Legal, that was just a story made up by early Washington biographers. Now, if you look at Mount Vernon's website, it has a whole page on Washington and his religious beliefs. And it starts off by saying, when studying the religious beliefs of George Washington, it's difficult to make absolute concrete conclusions. Depending on the source examined, Washington has been painted in different lights, ranging from a deist to a believing Christian. No matter what precise conclusion is obtained, there are common facts surrounding Washington's relationship with religion. Once again, this is from the Mount Vernon site. The first one is Washington was a great-great-grandson of Lawrence Washington, who was an Anglican pastor. Regarding direct church participation, Washington was a devoted member of the Anglican Church. The third one in regard to personal spirituality, Washington was generally private about his religious life. Washington is reported to have had regular private prayer sessions, and personal prayer was a large part of his life. One well-known report stated that Washington's nephew witnessed him doing personal devotions with an open Bible while kneeling in both the morning and the evening. It is clear that when it comes to religion, Washington was a private man, more so than other aspects of his life. Once again, this is from the Mount Vernon website. Also, it said Washington was said to have refused to take part in active church participation, but there were conflicting reports. One states that Washington did participate in Holy Communion before taking control of the Continental Army, but not afterwards. Washington, however, would often leave church early, leaving Martha Washington behind. There's also a debate as to whether Washington believed in an afterlife. While it's possible that he did not believe in a doctrinal Christian heaven, it is also possible that he was careful about whom he referenced in mentioning a joyful afterlife. And then notably, Washington did see God as guiding the creation of the United States. So what you get when you are talking about Washington and his religious background, this shrouded in mystery type thing, it's really very interesting to look at, simply because, as you know, the first of hearts of many, I actually forget the phrase, I had it on the tip of my tongue, but he's so revered in the political atmosphere, and especially historically within the creation of the Union. Now, there was an article that came out by a man named, Ben Emerson. There we go. Sorry about that. Ben Emerson. It was titled George Washington's Conversion to Catholicism. And it made some claims. But then there was a retort that came out in 2009 titled, "Did George Washington Convert to Catholicism?" with a question mark. And joining us now on the Bear Brief on the Crusade Channel, which is King Size Truth from Radio Size Speakers, is a very special guest, Ryan Grant of Mediatrix Press. Welcome to the program, Ryan.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Excellent. Would you like to take a moment to introduce yourself to my audience in case they have not heard you before?
Indeed. Thank you. I am a historian, and I run Mediatrix Press, as you've mentioned, and I know Mike's been running commercials for us, which is a small press based in Idaho. We basically reprint books, and we also print translations, mostly on theological subjects. And of late, it's been St. Robert Bellarmine in his famous volume, The Controversies, been doing that piecemeal, the 2 million words in Latin, working that into an English dress. And then St. Alphonsus Liguori, who's the church's moral doctor. So I've been translating his moral theology for the very first time in English. And apart from a few other works here and there, and a lot of books that are in the public domain, we reprint. And so, and personally, I'm a historian and I'm a researcher as well as a Latinist. And so I do research in various libraries, mostly the Vatican, but also at least online anyway, the Bibliothèque Nationale in Paris and other places, mostly just in areas of historical, other things that one day will become a book when I've got things in order. And so in other matters, pertaining to history, especially the 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries, it's kind of the period where I'm most alive historically. It's just where I'm more or less into everything.
Excellent. Excellent. Ironically enough, or coincidentally enough is probably a better way to say it, my undergrad was in history with a concentration in early colonial settlement. So we do have a little bit in common on that. Now, for this article that you wrote, "Did George Washington Convert to Catholicism?" It seems like it's a retort or a rebuttal to this first article by Ben Emerson. Now, where did you find that article? How did you come across that first article from Ben?
From Ben, let's see, something might have got mixed up because I haven't actually written an article on this subject.
Oh, okay.
You might be thinking of Marion T. Horvat. You might be looking at her articles. That's by her title. And she's the one that looks like she's responding to Emerson.
Okay. Have you read the article by?
I have. Yeah, I have. And so it's worth talking about. So where does this whole business about George Washington converting to the faith? Because we don't hear about it in early texts. We don't see it anywhere in any kind of Catholic books or anything, or even of that time. So where did this all come from? And really, the very first written historical account that makes any reference to Washington's claim or tries to relate any of the evidence is from 1900. It's the very first time it appears anywhere. So it's about 101 years after the event. So American Catholic Historical Researches, volume 1617, they have an article which I can't remember if Dr. Horvat mentions this in her essay, but anyway, so they have it which says, quote, "It has often been the subject of regretful remark among the good people who appreciated the pure and exalted character of Washington, that he seemed to make no mention of religion in his last moments and make no preparation for the step into the awful eternity beyond this life. In this connection, the writer recently came across a curious legend current among current among the colored people living for the past few generations along the Maryland and Virginia shores of the Potomac adjoining Mount Vernon, that George Washington on his deathbed was baptized a Catholic. Quote, Massa George, they say, was a good man, but he done gone back on when he died. And the story they tell as follows, that the night before Washington died, during the fierce storm, his colored body servant came riding down to the bank of the Potomac, and after being ferried across, said he had come in search of a Catholic priest. After some delay, one of the old Jesuit fathers from the mission on the Maryland side was found, taken over to the river to Mount Vernon, where he went at once to Mr. Washington's room and remained there with him 3 hours. When he left, he seemed much gratified and said to those about him that there need be no more apprehension for Mr. Washington, as the future of his soul was secure. He was then taken back to the Maryland shore, and the old, quote unquote, the old darkies tell with unvarying detail, yet you have the dated language is 1900, yeah. Tell with unvarying detail that their fathers believe Washington died a Catholic. In addition, the Jesuit record says that on the day after the visit to Mount Vernon, the old Jesuit went to the superior of the mission and related the fact of his journey, handed the superior a sealed packet saying, "I am not permitted to detail what has transpired between Mr. Washington and myself in his room at Mount Vernon. But I have written it out carefully here, and after we both have passed away, an occasion requires this can be opened and its contents made public." The superior took the paper and placed it among the records of the mission, where it remained until shortly after the death of the old Jesuit, when it was boxed up, still unopened, with a lot of other papers, and sent to the headquarters of the order in Rome, where it is still supposed to be awaiting the fortunate chance that will disclose it to the hand of some appreciative investigator who may throw some light on this very curious historical question, unquote. So that's the account in 1900 record. And so it's just kind of like at the starting point. And so as the record kind of develops, they start adding details to it. So then, you know, here it just says an unnamed Jesuit priest. And of course, omitting the fact that there were no Jesuits at this time. That's the other thing, that whoever made this up was unaware of the fact that in those years, even if they were formally Jesuits, the Jesuit order had been suppressed by Pope Clement XIV. So they were not, you know, who died several years earlier. Anyway, so we're already up to Pius VI. So there's no chance that this is actually, you know, that they're reflecting things correctly. We don't seem to understand how that worked at that time. But as it goes on, then they add on Father Neely. And so, and as the kind of identify him as the Jesuit, I believe, unless I'm mistaken, that first happened in the 1952 Denver Catholic Register article, which is kind of the main source that everybody uses for this conversion account. So they, you know, more or less give the same story, but then they make it Father Neely, right, who is the provost of Georgetown. And this actually is a useful thing, as it helps us identify and debunk it a little bit. Because as the president of Georgetown, he has papers, he has secretaries. I mean, an absence like that, you know, would have been noted and recorded for several days, and especially in December. And it's not even certain that Father Neely was even present in December at Georgetown. He may not have been there at all. So because at the time, Bishop Carroll was trying to get him named as a what we now call an auxiliary bishop. So that's, you know, another point that's curious in the legend that doesn't seem to, you know, it doesn't seem to wash very well. So that very first source I mentioned, the researches from 1900, they conclude their article on it that the alleged visit of the Jesuit father is largely improbable. Nothing in Washington's life gives a basis for the belief in its probability, and I do not believe he became a Catholic. And so that's how they kind of conclude, looking over some of that first evidence. But that's the story as it goes.
Excellent, excellent. This is the Bad Brief on the Crusade Channel, King Size Truth from Radio Size Speakers. I'm talking to my very special guest, Ryan Grant of Mediatrix Press, about this idea about George Washington converting to Catholicism as he died. And if you'd like to join in on this conversation, you can give us a call at 844-527-8723. Now, in the article, did George Washington convert to Catholicism? They said that Father Neal was from St. Mary's Mission. Is that in relation? Where would that be in relation to Georgetown? If that's something you would actually.
I don't know where the historical location of St. Mary's Mission was at that time. It was somewhere near, because Georgetown was actually an outgrowth of the old mission. But okay. I don't know exactly where it lay. So it's got, but it's somewhere in that proximate vicinity. But again, too, that's the other thing. I'm not sure if that's coming from Ben Emerson's article or Dr. Horvath's article is responding to it. But
coming from Horvath's.
Okay. Because Father Neely was supposed to, at least anyway, according to the timeline of his life that you can get from a few places, 19th Catholic Encyclopedia and a few others, he was the basically the provost of Georgetown. So he was, you know, would have been, you know, as he was an administrator of a college. It was not in particularly good health. So it's not, you know, it's one of those things that begs the credulity. especially this whole business of, you know, the father has a, which, or whether it's Father Neely or not, has this sealed packet, which I guess is supposed to have the documents pertaining to the alleged conversion, and those get sent off and never to be heard from again. It seems like it would be easy enough to just go to the Jesuit archives and find it. And it's not an impossible place to get into. They're in Rome. They're, you know, fairly easy to find. And I've talked to a few people that have researched in there, and they said, I mean, granted, there's lots of archives from lots of places, but, I mean, things from America are in, you know, a certain place, and if that existed, it's discoverable.
Okay.
So, and as someone who works in archives, you know, archiving is one of those problems because when you deal with manuscripts, you never exactly know what you're going to get sometimes. You'll get a big packet of things and you'll be looking around, and they only give the barest in briefs when you're looking through the electronic card indexes and things, especially in the Vatican. But as you know, you might be turning, you'll find this document. It's amazing. You're like, oh, wow. You know, in fact, I was just reading in some journal that a researcher in Florence just found the arrest warrant that was made for Machiavelli when the Medici came back into power in Florence. And it was one of the things that they've been looking for years, and then he just, you know, stumbles on it in this little laundry list of government documents from the time. So, you know, so it's possible, but at the same time, it's also discoverable, and nobody's taken the time to do that yet. So it really remains an argument from silence, especially when you consider Washington's actual documented life.
Excellent. Now, let me ask you a question, Ryan, in your very nuanced opinion. Why do you think that there's such a pile-on to claim Washington's religion? Why are Catholics and evangelicals and all these people trying to claim that he was a so-and-so or he was a so-and-so? What do you think the genesis of that is?
Well, it starts right out, more or less off the bat. So the genesis... Let's start with the Protestant side of it, and then we'll kind of come to the Catholic side of it. So on the Protestant side of it, it starts off rather early. And so what happened is, in the 19th century, there was an event where Freemasonry, of which Washington was an adherent and very devout adherent to that, was coming into disrepute. Now, amongst the founding fathers, it was the thing. It was considered one of the founding blocks of the nation was Freemasonry and Enlightenment, and like Jefferson, you know, hoped that eventually his style of Unitarianism would be the creed of the country, and that, you know, because then everyone would be fully enlightened. Well, what happened was in 27 years or so after his death, after Washington's death in 1826, there was a man named William Morgan, and he was a Freemason, and so supposedly he had revealed Masonic secrets, and I forget the context where he did it, whether it was in a bar or some other place. But anyway, he had after revealing these secrets, he was kidnapped away from his wife and family, brutally murdered, and then the body was discovered. And of course, the murderers were discovered shortly after. So they were put on trial, and then after flipping, you know, their various hand gestures, were let off. Basically, all charges dismissed, and they disappeared. So that brought a, especially from, you know, more devout Protestants that really did not get Freemasonry, understand its influence, but understood it was there. This just got everybody, you know, angry. So Freemasonry became kind of like the big red herring. We've got to do something about this. And you actually had anti-Masonic political parties and other things suddenly rise up. And as a result, for example, like Andrew Jackson. He was a Freemason. There was a major anti-Masonic political candidate that ran against him in 1828. So so this was kind of alive and well. So what happens is that as this reaction kind of increases, a lot of people are kind of looking back. Jefferson was a Freemason. In fact, he was initiated in the Lodge of the Grand Orient. Washington was a Freemason. Paine was a Freemason, and a good number of others. We're all the serious Freemasons. And so what do you do with that? So the first thing you got to do is kind of reclaim the legend, kind of rewrite. So it's kind of the first step in the apotheosis of Washington, but as a, you got to remake him as a Christian. And so one of the figures that was responsible for that is Mason Locke Weems, who's an Anglican priest or minister, and definitely a kind of the maker of the propaganda of the religious idea of the American founders. So he writes in this interesting little poem about 1822, if I'm not mistaken, Swift, or maybe a little later, swift on angels' wings, the bright descended, while voices more than human warbling through the regions, being the great procession towards the gates of heaven. His glorious coming was seen far off, and myriads of mighty angels hastened forth with golden harps to welcome the stranger. High in front of shadows were seen the beauteous forms of Franklin, Warren, Mercer, Scammell, and of him who fell at Quebec with all virtuous patriots who, on the side of Columbia, toiled their liberty. Oh, Columbia, such the brother band of thy martyred saints that now poured forth heaven's wide-opening gates to meet thy Washington, to meet their beloved chief who in days of his mortality had led their embattled squadrons to the war. I just lost my place. At sight of him, even these blessed spirits seemed to feel new rapture and to look more dazzlingly bright. In joyous throngs, they pour around him, they devour him with their eyes of love. They embrace him in transports of tenderness unutterable, while from their roseate cheeks, tears of joy such as angels weep roll down. So, I mean, it's Mason Locke weeps. Oh, no, sorry, I said 18, I meant 1922 earlier. It was 1918 when this was published. The history of the life, death, virtues, and exploits of General George Washington. So that's just one example of many where writers that would try to reinvent Washington as, you know, principally as a Protestant, as someone who is, you know, because he has a lot of virtues that recommend himself in his general moral conduct. But at the same time, he's not a Christian. And that's abundantly clear just looking at the historical record. So the Anglican pastor of Washington's own parish, Reverend James Abercrombie, when asked about Washington's religion, said, quote, Sir Washington was a deist. And that's quoted by Paul Bowler in his work, George Washington and Religion, which it's a really good study. And Bowler is a Christian. So he's fairly devout evangelical. So you can't come to someone like Bowler and say, oh, he has all these communist revisionists trying to, you know, undo the Christianity of our founding fathers, because unfortunately Bowler's a Christian and he's a historian, and he's just looking at the documentation available, and including, you know, this particular quote, which is in the Mount Vernon archives. Another thing that Bowler brings out is that Washington avoided the name of Christ whenever he could, right? And so, and likewise, even the word God was somewhat problematic for Washington. So he uses phrases like this: the great author of every public and private good, the almighty being who rules over the universe, the benign parent of the human race, the invisible hand which conducts the affairs of men, right, et cetera, et cetera. So all these kind of ideas of Washington as, you know, a Christian, you know, it's related. There's all kinds of, you know, examples where Washington astutely avoided any connections, any kind of affirmation of Christian creed. And that's another thing that Reverend Abercrombie is very clear about, is that Washington refused his services before his burial. Mm-hmm. Before his death and burial, he didn't want, and even in his burial, wasn't done by his Anglican vicar. He had a Masonic burial done precisely according to the Masonic ritual as it was at that time. So the Masonic apron that he wore was draped over his coffin, and this is the apron that he'd quote unquote baptized, you know, when he was laying the Capitol building.
You're referring to the actual procession that he led, right, in that full Masonic attire, right, in 1793.
Which was embroidered by Adrienne Lafayette, the wife of General Lafayette, and she was Washington's fellow Freemason brother at arms. And Lafayette had joined the Lodge of Saint Jean de Condé in, I think it was 1775, if I'm not mistaken. But in any event, so now this apron is present at his funeral, which was conducted by and two other Masons. One was a Presbyterian minister.
Now,
oh yeah, sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just, we're mentioning Freemasonry a lot. I know there's there's probably a lot of people who only see Freemasons as kind of an offshoot or a version, a similar version of like a Knights of Columbus, a bunch of guys who kind of get together and hang out. If you could you actually just give like a brief summary of what Freemasonry is?
Sure. Freemasonry, in a sense anyway, is a secret society that was founded out of the remnants of the old guilds, the ones that hadn't been quite suppressed in England. And this type of association was generally amongst English royalists before the English Civil War. So a lot of them in France started similar types of associations where they could meet and not have to worry about Republican spies in England keeping tabs on them, right? And so they had secret oaths, they had and that's kind of the first origins of it, right? And so it's a secret society largely to get together, and then it kind of transforms and grows in different ways, and it transplants over to this country. So prior to the revolution, at least, excuse me, the Freemasonic Lodge was largely a place where you could meet, and British officers were also part of it too, right? And so supposedly everything was supposed to be secret, and you were supposed to keep it yourself. So that's where that the founding fathers that were that favored independence could kind of talk freely without worrying about being caught, as everyone's taken all his oaths not to reveal anything under very horrible consequences. So, so you can discuss these things without being, killed for treason. At least that's the hope. The rituals and ceremony that had been developed by Freemasonry reflected its, which is not explicitly Christian. In fact, for the most part, at least for them, anti-Christian. Which is that I know you have a lot of Masons today. Like, oh yeah, we're happy to take in Christians, but your first oaths are to the lodge and to the supreme being. And so that's one of the things that reflects deism. Now you have to make distinctions between American Freemasonry and Freemasonry as it develops in the continent. And eventually these two will merge, largely because of the 19th century, the work of former Klansman Albert Pike, who reintroduces, the founder of Scottish Rite Freemasonry, or at least the popularizer of it. He's the one who kind of brings American Freemasonry into line with that practice of the continent. And in England, but beside any of that, so it doesn't quite have all the nefarious things that conspiracy theories will associate with Freemasonry, or conspiracy facts, depending which one you're talking about. But because some things are and some things aren't. So
yeah.
But beside that, so at this time, it's still kind of the American version is still in developing phases, but the key to understanding Freemasonry is deism. Okay, and that's one of the main ideas. So deism arises in the 1700s, and it was part and parcel of the way the Enlightenment develops in the United States. And so especially along the universities, a lot of the elite, for example, they are very much into the founding of deism in universities and whatnot. And in fact, four of the first five presidents began all their studies in university during the very formative years of deism in the 1700s. So deism basically believes that, well, there's a supreme being of sorts, basically like a founding principle, or Aristotle's unmoved mover type of thing. But according to Enlightenment ideas, he is someone that basically winds the clock that is the universe and watches it all go. So the creator that sets all principles and physics and science and the way the world works, and then gets back and doesn't mess with it. Okay, so that's in a nutshell deism. No Christ, no Savior. All of these things are just fun morals that if they're only useful in terms of helping men be good and not be bad, and otherwise they're just bad. This stuff's just humbug. Like it was said that Washington would read the Bible for whimsy, quote unquote. It was the only time he'd ever read it, according to Thomas Lear, who is his secretary when Washington was president. So deism became kind of the dominant creed at the College of William and Mary, which is the alma mater of both Monroe and Jefferson. And Washington was the chancellor there from 1788 until his death. All of this time, basically, it was known as the Deist College, because Christianity was merely optional, and deism was kind of the main thing there. So, and that factors very heavily into American Freemasonry. The you know, the concept of the supreme being, and you still see that reflected in a lot of Masonic documentation, that is wise, beneficent, and, you know, but only in as much as he set all the principles in the universe. And so he doesn't get into it and actually do anything. So miracles are, say, everyone knows about Jefferson's Bible, right? Say all the miracles are taken out of it, or his Life of Christ or whatever it was, whereas you see no miracles in it. There was also something called the Masonic Bible, which is similar. It's got, you know, miraculous stuff stripped out of it. It's made to accord to reason. And that's what Washington takes his oath of office on, not on a Christian Bible. Not in the King James Bible or the Geneva Bible, which would have been the two Bibles that you might have seen in the United States at that time. Instead, it was on the Masonic Bible.
And so how does Masonic Freemasonry, how does that directly clash? Besides, you've already mentioned a little bit of it, how it strips away the miracles and things of that nature. What other ways does it directly clash with the idea of Catholicism?
In Catholicism specifically, the regenerative nature of baptism in any way, shape, or form, any ceremony or a symbol, okay, any kind of devotion to even the idea of asking God for assistance, is God tinkering with the natural order? So the idea of intercession, redemption, in fact, actually I'll summarize another historian. Let's see. Where's the quote I'm looking for? Here we go. So again, Paul Bowler, George Washington and religion. So this will kind of help out to see that. If to believe in the divinity and resurrection of Christ and his atonement for the sins of man and to participate in the sacrament of the Lord's Supper are requisites for the Christian faith, then Washington, on the evidence which we have, can hardly be considered a Christian, except in the most nominal sense possible. He was more of a Unitarian than anything else in his apparent lack of doctrinal convictions, unquote. It's on page 90 to 91 of that work. So, and you kind of see that kind of a reflection of in Freemasonry, the idea of sacraments, the idea of divine authority on earth, the idea of anything, all of this, again, constitutes the deity kind of breaking the order, very order he himself established. And that's purely unreasonable to an Enlightenment deist. So you can't possibly have that. So that's one of those principal elements in, at least in the Freemasonry of that time, that, you know, you couldn't possibly have this type of, you know, thought and be an enlightened person. So, and another example, if you see in like, one of the interesting ways that people repurpose art, so iconoclasm, okay, and iconoclasm, which we take to be generally just vandalism, the people involved in it generally actually have a sense of what they're trying to do in terms of the art. They're actually trying to repurpose it for a new end, to say something new. So if you look at what happens in the French Revolution, and you look at the Church of Saint-Sulpice in Paris, and you can see where Robespierre's directory had spent a lot of money getting sculptors to repurpose a lot of the Christian iconography on Saint-Sulpice because they want to make it a temple of reason. Okay. So one of the classic images you'll see, especially in the Baroque period, are angels holding a chalice or a cross or things of this sort. So one of the places on Saint-Sulpice where at one point the angel is holding a chalice, which represents faith in religious iconography in the Middle Ages as well as in the Baroque artistry, they've completely scraped this chalice off and they've grafted in a torch, which is it's a Masonic symbol. It's a big Masonic symbol for the light of reason, as opposed to the darkness of believing in popes and Bibles and things of this sort. And so that's kind of the direction that they want to do. So, I mean, it is in a certain sense of vandalism, but it's also a new form of art. So they're now telling you where Enlightenment man is going to go.
Do you know the story of the Capitol Chapel, where it's one of those basic chapels that you would see at like an airport or something like that? It's just a room, but the one piece of stained glass is actually Washington kneeling and with his hands clasped in prayer. So I find that very interesting. It seems like it's very similar to what you're saying.
It is. It's kind of But nature abhors a vacuum. It's natural to have a religion of the state. You see this in classical philosophy, in ancient Athens, in ancient Greece. You have like a sort of state religion that is just broadly speaking, paganism. And that's connected with your notion of patriotism. In Latin, that's pietas, which we take to mean piety, but it also means basically your veneration for your country. And how do you show that pietas? It's by taking part in the public liturgia, that is the Greek word for the public act, right, where we get our word liturgy from, and meaning the public worship of the state. That's how we get this... this problem in the 3rd century, or in the 1st century, 2nd, 3rd century, Christians who won't worship the state religion. They say, hey, we'll be good citizens. We'll, you know, we pray for the emperor. We don't break the laws. Well, yeah, but you don't worship the gods. Well, unless you pinch incense to Zeus, you're not a patriotic Roman. And there we are. And that's where the issue comes in. So a good conservative patriotic Roman is his reaction is going to put Christians to death. Because they're not patriotic. They're, you know, they might as well be communist or something. I don't know, but or they're even charged with being atheists sometimes, even which is ridiculous. But you know, for that reason, so the state naturally needs a religious principle, like as like Pope Leo XIII teaches, and several other popes too in this vein, that the state is a body that requires a spiritual life. It requires a soul. So if you remove religion from the backdrop, the state is going to create it, and you know, to create its own religious sense. And you look at the American civic religion, which largely is, I mean, we have our own processions, right, parades. Yep. We have, yeah, about to have bigger ones. You have your patron saints, you have your temples, right, your churches, big basilicas. Mm-hmm. I mean, you look at the Lincoln Memorial, who's also commemorated today, in the Feast of Liberty. You know, again, it's secular holidays. The word holiday is just a corruption of the word holy day. And they have, the state has its secular holidays, its secular saints. So you stick, you look at Lincoln. I mean, Lincoln is sitting like Zeus. It is just like the Greek statue of Zeus, as it's related from antiquity. Sitting up there, Lincoln is now like Zeus, like this divine god of wisdom. And I mean, and of course, with Lincoln, calling him a deist would be very generous, you know, in terms of his religious convictions. But
well, it's also interesting that temple, that monument itself is actually called the temple. That inscription is actually used inside, where in some of the writings say within this temple. I don't remember the actual wording of it, but the word temple is actually used within the Lincoln Memorial. And I think that's very interesting when you're talking about how there's this perversion of the two being brought together. You mentioned Pope Leo XIII, and apparently in that Ben Emerson article, he quotes Pope Leo XIII praising Washington in one of his encyclicals in January 6, 1893, where he says, "We highly esteem and love exceedingly the young and vigorous American nation, in which we plainly discern latent forces for the advancement alike of civilization and of Christianity. Without morality, the state cannot endure, a truth which that illustrates citizens of yours, whom we have just mentioned, the great Washington, with keenness of insight worthy of his genius and statesmanship, perceived and proclaimed." Does that ring true at all, or is that just completely out of left field?
Well, part of it is dependent on what he himself received, with the information that Leo XIII got. That's one. And at this point, you know, the only kind of information going out of America is of this great Christian man. But Washington also did have natural virtues. Mm. And he, you know, that were, you know, very, very upright, very, very positive. So, you know, in many ways, very moral. So the, but at the same time, I mean, you can give like a praise to a non-Catholic. Okay. And in a very civic sense, actually, you know what it would do? Archbishop Carroll's circular letter to the clergy on 29th December 1799, that kind of really lays it out. He says, quote, "Roman Catholics in common with our fellow citizens of the United States have to deplore the irreparable loss our country has sustained by the death of that great man who contributed so essentially to the establishment and preservation of its peace and prosperity. We are, therefore, called upon by every consideration of respect to his memory and gratitude for his services, to bear a public testimony of our high sense of his worth when living and our sincere sorrow for being deprived of that protection, which the United States derived from his wisdom, his experience, his reputation, and the authority of his name. So it speaks of those wishing to eulogize the president, and he adds, they are advised not to form their discourses on the model of a funeral sermon deduced from a text of scripture, but rather to compose an oration such as might be delivered in an academy. If these discourses shall be delivered in churches where the Holy Sacrament is usually kept, it will be proper to remove it previously with due honor to some decent place. So essentially, you know, it's a tribute being authored by Catholics to a virtuous non-Catholic for goods that they've, you know, acquired. And okay. So Leo XIII basically is doing that. He's giving, because he's writing, you know, at the same time as he's also, you know, condemning many things that go on in America. He's also praising its good points and, you know, so he's trying to find kind of this balance. How can we make it better? The light of the Catholic faith, but still, we want to, you know, so he's not just, you know, coming out with, okay, yeah, we hate you because you suck, because you don't have this. he's being far more nuanced and saying, well, let's take the good where there's good, and there is good here on these points. And therefore, let's bring these types of things, you know, let's comment on these things. And then, of course, Washington, who the whole world recognizes as having been a great man in a natural sense. So yeah. As it is, we acknowledge various people in history as being great men who were, you know, certainly not Catholic or pagans, you know, Aristotle, Socrates, Plato, Julius Caesar, Caesar's got issues, certainly. But anyway, he's always been held as one of the worthies, right?
Yeah.
Even Charlemagne, who did become Catholic, you know, the church has given veneration for his accomplishments, even though various things he did in his life, you know, can't really be venerated, such as his various affairs and, you know, things of that sort. But
this is the Bad Brief on the Crusade Channel, King-Sized Truth from Radio-Sized Speakers. I'm talking to my very special guest today, Ryan Grant, about George Washington's religion and his supposed conversion to Catholicism. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can give us a call at 844-527-8723. I actually did find I just want to make clear when I was talking about Lincoln's memorial, the actual inscription says, in this temple, as in the hearts of the people for whom he saved the Union, and the memory of Abraham Lincoln is enshrined forever. So yes, I want to thank you, Suzanne, for clearing that up for me. So yeah, there is that worship of specific people within the state. And I completely agree that, you know, just because somebody is not a Catholic does not mean that they're totally a terrible person with no redeeming value. It's very interesting when we point out Washington's virtues, because he does have virtues. We all look at them and we say, oh, there's things here that are, if we make sure we look at them historically accurate, not the I didn't chop down the cherry tree kind of things. The idea that he lived more, that these virtues lined up with that Stoic philosophy, and to praise the ideas and the virtues, but only so far as to not, I don't want to say not make them emulate, but where does, as a Catholic, how far do we go in the praise of Washington, and while recognizing that this is a guy who from that article said only 13 months before his death, he declared to the Grand Lodge of Maryland, quote, so far as I am acquainted with the doctrines and principles of Freemasonry, I conceive them to be founded in benevolence and to be exercised only for the good of mankind. I cannot therefore upon this ground withdraw from it. So how do we balance the two?
I think principally I don't know, because part of it comes down to your political view. So if you're the type of person that thinks the founding of America was good and everything that the founding fathers had done was a wonderful thing, then you have to you'll look at it and say, yeah, you know, we should, you know, find some things that we can, you know, support in Washington's character, and certainly, you know, his valor, and then, you know, in the fight against the British that led to the creation of our country, is working with various alliances, his temperance and other things. So you'll want to celebrate those particular things. unless you're someone like myself, that it's probably going to offend a good number of your listeners.
That's all right.
As a monarchist, as someone that I don't see the American founding as an unqualified good, and I think there's actually, even though I don't think the British Empire is all that great either, but there's a lot of different historical issues and red herrings that I think really have to be gone through. So I look at someone like Washington myself, and again, I could see these particular virtues in terms of his temperance and his mildness and other things. But and I'm happy to give it, pans to someone who has certain things in order. I mean, he's a statesman. He's a true statesman in a real sense, unlike the people that run around today.
Yeah.
They're so-called politicians, which are kind of the exact opposite of statesmen. So I guess we'll intersect this with a question you asked before. Why would religious people want to try to make Washington into, one of them, right? And so kind of use that to bring into this question. So what you should really want to do properly is adhere to your faith, look at what the principles of your faith demand, and say, okay, we can recognize that as good, and we're going to build on that accomplishment and make it better by bringing this into the Catholic faith, right? If you believe in the Catholic faith, you should hope that the entire country should convert and become Catholic. That's why you see figures like Archbishop Hughes in New York. He was a fantastic bishop in the 19th century. Really led, it was a level of political Catholicism that was unseen in the country before. And, he declared Catholicism should conquer all nations. We shall, it can convert the president, the military, the Congress, by word, prayer, and example, right? And so that's the kind of the goal that Catholics should have. And, of course, likewise, if someone's a Protestant, they should want, if they believe their faith is true, they should want all their fellow countrymen to embrace that and believe that, right? But in America, there's a curious thing. We don't believe that. As if we're, good Americans don't want to do that. Good Americans, everyone do what they want, not preach the faith too heavily, especially American Catholics from the very beginning, especially the hierarchy, kind of had this idea that there's something to be an American, which is like a vocation separate unto being a Catholic, and even more important for many of them. So in part of it comes from the history of being cowed, being a second-class citizen in your own country. You look at the British Empire, the state of Catholicism there, where it was illegal until 1830. Ireland, right, you look at, and of course, where many Irish are coming from, too, that are coming to this country. Although, granted, the first Irish were actually Presbyterians, believe it or not. But the later waves of Irish immigrants or Catholic have lived under a situation where if they, go out in the middle of the night and start walking into the woods where they're going to have a wagon come through with where it's fake cabinets and everything will be flipped around. It'll be an altar and everyone's going to have mass now. And if you get caught there, you're dead. If you get caught, you will be killed. So you can't practice your faith openly. Now you come to a country that's, again, majority Protestant, but a little bit different. And it has kind of a history of allowing certain levels of toleration that go back to the 19th century and certain things with the Baltimores and whatnot. But there's still this idea that we don't want to rock the boat. We don't want to really preach the faith because that's going to get us into trouble. So, look, religious freedom. We're free and everyone's free. So it's like, I'll scratch my back, you'll scratch your back. And we're all free to do what we want. But being an American is more important. And that's kind of the way the Constitution sees it, and certainly the way Jefferson saw it, that religion, Washington's farewell address is the same type of thing. Religion, so long as it makes men good, is preferable, whatever it might be, doesn't matter. So when the state, again, so the state not embracing an actual religion would become the religion itself. But the way in which that was manifested was directed by a good number of Protestants. So Catholics for a very long time, even though you have freedom of religion, and there's a lot of examples of just clear anti-Catholicism in American history. Sometimes it's amusing, like a certain Catholic that was elected to the South Carolina legislature in the 1820s. And they said, well, you can't take your seat until you can agree to the principles of the Christian church. And he said, excellent. What are the principles of the Christian church? And then, because he reckoned, it was kind of like St. Paul sitting there before the Sadducees and the Pharisees saying, I'm on trial for the resurrection of the body. Now I'll just watch them fight it out. And they did, right? It's a similar thing here. The Presbyterians and the Anglicans and all these groups are fighting it out. They're all fighting it out over who's going to be where it and what, you know, and to what the Congregationalists, you know, they can't agree on anything. So in the end, they finally let him take his seat. You know? So they, you get funny things like that. But then you have other examples, like when they burn convents down. Because these lurid tales of what must be going on there. Why else would women, you know, renounce the world and not get married and come into a convent, except that it's really a convent full of Satan-worshipping lesbians? And stuff like that gets passed around in pamphlets, and people actually believed it. So they go burn down the convent and find out every last thing was absolutely false and say, oh, sorry about that. Oh, well, you're on your own. We're out of here.
Yeah.
Exactly. No recompense ever made. The know-nothings, the Whigs, right? You know, firebombing Catholic churches. It was a big thing in the Catholic experience. So, and I could go on and on with other examples. But anyway, the Catholic school question, you know, things of this sort. So for American Catholics, there's kind of this idea, well, I want to be loyal to my country and I want to be patriotic, but we want to show that Catholicism has a place here. And so thus you have, you know, what probably my theory on the Washington conversion story originates from Jesuits at Georgetown, kind of passing this down at some point created this kind of oral tradition, which wound its way into, you know, the researches that I mentioned earlier from 1900, and then to the 1952 Denver Catholic Register article, which are the only two written sources, period, historically for this particular narrative. And so people try to embrace it. Yeah, if we could show that the guy that is America, when you think of America, it's Washington, right? If you want to think of anything about American origins, more so than Paine or Jefferson or anyone else, it's Washington, bar none. And if he was a Catholic, we guarantee our place at the table of religion in America. Because that's essentially what people have been trained to settle for. And so that's why it would be desirable to have this whole kind of legend, even though from a historical standpoint, there's simply not a shred of evidence for it. And the worst part is that the most irresponsible part of the legend is that Washington's death is extremely well documented, again, by Tobias Lear, who we mentioned was Washington's secretary. He basically says he took his own pulse, which is the consummate gesture of our age, that is the consummate enlightenment gesture, in his final hours, and he died. We can actually faithfully record Washington's final hours.
Yeah, we actually have it in that article. Article, about 10 minutes before he expired, which was between 10 and 11 o'clock, he breathing became easier. He lay quiet. He withdrew his hand from mine, and he felt his own pulse. I saw his countenance change. I spoke to Dr. Craig, who sat by the fire. He came to the bedside. The general's hand fell from his wrist. I took it in mine and put it to my bosom. Dr. Crank put his hand over his eyes, and he expired without a struggle or sigh.
Right. Which, there's so many people around him, it's not really plausible that a Catholic priest is able to be rowed across, come on in, and nobody take any account of it, write anything down of it. And is this the behavior of somebody that has just converted, you know, to the Catholic faith, right? Why would somebody do that? You know, when you're constructing things historically, it's like people are familiar with textbooks, and then people are familiar with your secondary sources, your type of your books that a historian, some prof or whatever has written that, you know, on some subject that elucidates some subject, right? And so people will read various books, and people will read a book and think they're a historian now all of a sudden because they read the book, right? Then there's the primary sources. Then there's the historians that do the work that becomes that secondary source literature. And sad to say, the putrid tertiary source textbook tradition, which I hate with a passion. But anyway, yeah. I mean, seriously, we still have textbooks teaching Columbus sailed to prove the world was round. And that was shown to be false over 100 years ago. And it's still in the darn textbooks.
Well, yeah, the problem with textbooks, you can get me off on a tirade there for an hour. It's all baked into whoever is purchasing and so forth.
Right.
I'll give you the last word right here. We got to wrap it up.
Okay. So the last word anyway, so real history is done by going to these primary sources, by going to the direct sources. So when you go to the direct sources for Washington, you have his diary, and diaries are much more important than memoirs, by the way, because a diary is what you're writing as events are happening and unfolding. Whereas a memoir, you're looking back, trying to remember. And I know if I try to remember for like 6 months ago, I might be confused about what had happened. So Washington's diary mentions nothing about Christ, nothing about the Christian religion. The word God appears twice in the whole of his diary. for years and years and years. His letters are the same way. His the only thing he's passionate about, principally, is Freemasonry and deism. And he makes this very clear in all of his public addresses. Jefferson actually tells a story of some Protestant clergymen that attempted to trap Washington, that attempted to get him in on, to declare whether he was a Christian or not. And so Jefferson, in his diary, relates, the old fox was too cunning for them. He answered every one of their articles, particularly except that, the one that wanted him to affirm belief in God, that is, which he completely passed over without notice. Right. And so there's no basis for all the various popular legends about Washington at prayer at Valley Forge, that saying grace over meals, the cherry, as you mentioned in your opening, the cherry tree, etc. There's no indication that he ever took these things seriously or wanted to be involved with them. So why is it that all of a sudden at the end of his life, he's now going to become Catholic, and which is the most hated probably religion of all, except possibly Quakerism?
And all right, Ryan, I hate to interrupt it because it sounds like you're about to get to a great point. I'd love to have you come back on with me and finish that up, but we're actually out of time.
Okay.
I really thank you for coming on. That concludes today's Barrett Briefer on the Crusade Channel, King Radio Size Speakers. I'm Rick Barrett. Grace and peace to all of you.